Chapter 25. Once, while guiding some duck hunters born on Hyperion into the fens, I asked one of them, an airship pilot who commanded the weekly dirigible run down the Ninetales from Equus to Aquila, what his job was like. "Piloting an airship," he'd said. As the ancient line goes, long hours of boredom broken by minutes of sheer panic. This trip was a bit like that. I don't mean to say that I was bored. Just the interior of the spaceship, with its books and old hollows and grand piano, was interesting enough to keep me from being bored for the next 10 days, not to mention getting to know my traveling companions. But already we had experienced these long, slow, pleasantly idle periods, punctuated by interludes of wild adrenaline rush. I admit that it had been disturbing in Parvati's system to sit out of sight of the vid pickup and watch this child threaten to kill herself and us if the pack ship did not back off. I'd spent 10 months dealing blackjack on Felix, one of the Ninetales, and had watched a lot of gamblers. This 11-year-old was one hell of a poker player. Later, when I asked her if she would have carried through on the threat and opened our last pressurized level to space, she only smiled that mischievous smile and made a vague gesture with her right hand, a sort of flicking away, as if she were brushing the thought out of the air. I grew used to that gesture in later months and years. "Well, how did you know that PAX captain's name?" I asked. I expected to hear some revelation about the powers of a proto-messiah, but Aenea only said, "He was waiting at the Sphinx when I stepped out a week ago. I guess I heard someone call his name." I doubted that. If the father captain had been at the Sphinx, Pax Army standard procedure would have had him buttoned into combat armor and communicating on secure channels. But why would the child lie? Why am I seeking logic or sanity here? I'd asked myself at the moment. There hasn't been any so far. When Aenea had gone below decks to take a shower after our dramatic departure from Parvati system, the ship had tried to reassure Abetic and me. "Do not worry, gentlemen. I would not have allowed you to die from decompression." The android and I had exchanged a look. I think that both of us were wondering whether the ship knew what it would have done, or whether the child had some special control over it. As the days of the second leg of the voyage passed, I found myself brooding about the situation and my reaction to it. The main problem, I realized, had been my passivity, almost irrelevancy, during this whole trip. I was 27 years old, an ex-soldier, man of the world, even if the world was only backwater Hyperion, and here I had let a child deal with the one real emergency we'd faced. I understood why Abetic had been so passive in the situation. He was, after all, conditioned by bioprogramming and centuries of habit to defer to human decisions. But why had I been such a stump? Martin Silenus had saved my life and sent me on this insane quest to protect the girl, to keep her alive and help her get wherever she had to go. So far, all I had done was fly a carpet and hide behind a piano while the kid dealt with a Pax warship. The four of us, including the ship, talked about that Pax warship during those first few days out from Parvati space. If Aenea was right, if Father Captain DeSoya had been on Hyperion during the opening of the tomb, then the Pax had found some way to take a shortcut through Hawking space. The implications of that reality were more than sobering. They scared the shit out of me. Aenea did not seem overly worried. The days passed, and we fell into the comfortable, if a bit claustrophobic, shipboard routine. Aenea playing the piano after dinner, all of us grazing in the library, checking the ship's hollows and navigation logs for any clue as to where it had taken the console. There were many clues, none definitive. Playing cards in the evening, she was a formidable poker player. And occasionally exercising, which I did by asking the ship to set the containment field to 1.3G just in the stairwell, and then running up and down the 6 stories worth of spiral steps for 45 minutes. I'm not sure what it did for the rest of my body, but my calves, thighs, and ankles soon looked like they belonged to some Jovian world elephantoid. When Aenea realized that the field could be tailored to small regions of the ship, there was no stopping her. She began sleeping in a bubble of zero-G on the fugue deck. She found that the table on the library deck could be morphed into a billiard table, and she insisted on at least 2 games a day, each time under different G-loads. One night, I heard a noise while reading on the navigation level, went down the stairs to the hollow pit level, and found the hull irised open. The balcony extended without the piano there, and a giant sphere of water, perhaps 8 or 10 meters across, floating between the balcony and the outer containment field. What the hell? It's fun! Came a voice from within the pulsing blob of shifting water. A head with wet hair broke the surface, hanging upside down 2 meters above the floor of the balcony. Come on in! Cried the girl. The water's warm! I leaned away from the apparition, putting my weight on the railing and trying not to think of what would happen if that localized bubble of the field failed for a second. Has Abedic seen this? I said. The pale shoulders shrugged. The fractal fireworks were pulsing and folding out beyond the balcony, casting incredible colors and reflections on the sphere of water. The sphere itself was a great blue blob with lighter patches on the surface and interior, where bubbles of air shifted. Actually, it reminded me of photos of old Earth I had seen. Ania ducked her head under, was a pale form kicking through the water for a moment, and re-emerged 5 meters up the curved surface. Smaller globules splashed free and curved back to the surface of the larger sphere, herded there by the field differential, I assumed, splashing and sending complex, concentric circles rippling across the surface of the water globe. Come on in, she said again. I mean it. I don't have a suit. Ania floated a second, kicked over onto her stomach, and dived again. When she emerged, head completely upside down from my perspective this time, she said, Who has a suit? You don't need one. I knew she was not joking, because during her dive, I had seen the pale vertebrae pressing against the skin of her back, her ribs, and her still boy-like butt reflecting the fractal light like 2 small white mushrooms poking up from a pond. All in all, the sight of our 12-year-old Messiah-to-be's backside was about as sexually arousing as seeing hollow slides of Aunt Murph's new grandkitties in the tub. Come on in, Rawl, she called again, and dived for the opposite side of the sphere. I hesitated only a second before kicking off my robe and outer clothes. I kept on not only my undershorts, but the long undershirt I often wore as pajamas. For a moment, I stood on the balcony, not having the slightest clue as to how to get into the sphere several meters above me. Then I heard, Jump, dummy! From somewhere on the upper arc of the blob, and I jumped. The transition to 0G began about a meter and a half up. The water was damned cold. I pivoted, shouted from the cold, felt everything contractible on my body contract, and began splashing around, trying to keep my head above the curved surface. I was not surprised when Abedic came out on the balcony to see what the shouting was all about. He folded his arms and leaned against the railing, crossing his legs at the ankles. The water's warm, I lied through chattering teeth. Come on in. The android smiled and shook his head like a patient parent. I shrugged and pivoted and dived. It took me a second or two to remember that swimming is much like moving in 0G, that floating in water in 0G is much like ordinary swimming. Either way, the resistance of the water made the experience more swim-like than 0G-like, although there was the added fun of coming across an air bubble somewhere inside the sphere and pausing there to catch one's breath before paddling around underwater again. After a moment of cartwheeling disorientation, I came to a meter-wide bubble, stopped myself before tumbling out into the sphere, and looked directly above me to see Ania's head and shoulders emerging. She looked down at me and waved. The skin on her bare chest was goosebumpy from either the cool water or cooler air. Some fun, huh? She said, spluttering water out of her face and brushing back her hair with both hands. Her blonde brown hair looked much darker when wet. I looked at the girl and tried to see her mother in her, the dark-haired Lusian detective. It was no use. I had never seen an image of Braunlamia, only heard descriptions from the Kantos.
"The hard part's keeping yourself from flying out of the water when you get to the edge," said Aenea as our bubble shifted and contracted, the wall of water curving around and above us. "Race you to the outside."
She pivoted and kicked, and I tried to follow, but made the mistake of flailing across the air bubble. My God, I hoped that neither Abedic nor the child saw that pathetic spasm of arms and legs, and ended up at the edge of the sphere half a minute behind her. We treaded water there. The ship and balcony were out of sight beneath us. The surface of the water curved away to the left and right, dropping out of sight like waterfalls on all sides of us, while above us the crimson fractals expanded, exploded, contracted, and expanded again. "I wish we could see the stars," I said, and was surprised that I had spoken aloud.
"Me too," said Aenea.
Her face was raised to the disturbing light show, and I thought I saw a shadow of sadness flicker across her features.
"I'm cold," she said at last.
I could see her clenched jaws now, sense her effort to keep her teeth from chattering.
"Next time I tell the ship to build a pool, I'll remind it not to use cold water."
"You'd better get out," I said. We swam down and around the curve of the sphere. The balcony seemed to be a wall rising to greet us, its only anomaly the form of Abedic, standing sideways from it, holding out a large towel for Aenea.
"Close your eyes," she said.
I did, and felt the heavy zero-g globules of splash water strike my face as she flailed her way right through the surface tension of the sphere and floated beyond it. A second later, I heard the slap of her bare feet as she landed on the balcony. I waited a few more seconds and opened my eyes. Abedic had set the voluminous towel around her, and she was huddled in it, teeth chattering now despite her efforts to stop them.
"Be careful," she said. "Rotate as soon as you get out of the water, or you'll fall on your head and break your neck."
"Thanks," I said, having no intention of leaving the sphere before she and Abedic left the balcony. They did so a moment later, and I paddled out, kicked arms and legs in a wild attempt to turn 180 degrees before gravity reasserted itself, pivoted too far, overcompensated, and landed heavily on my rear end. I pulled down the extra towel that Abedic had thoughtfully left on the railing for me, mopped my face, and said, "Ship, you can collapse the zero-g microfield now." I realized my mistake an instant later, but before I could countermand the order, several hundred gallons of water collapsed onto the balcony, a massive waterfall of bone-chilling weight crashing down from a great height. If I had been directly under it, it might well have killed me, a mildly ironic end to a great adventure. But since I was sitting a couple of meters from the edge of the deluge, it merely smashed me against the balcony, caught me up in its vortex as it spilled up and over the railing, and threatened to fling me out into space and down past the stern of the ship 15 meters below, down to the bottom of the ellipsoid bubble of containment field, where I would end up like a drowned insect in an ovoid beaker. I grabbed at the railing and held on while the torrent roared by.
"Sorry," said the ship, realizing its own error and reshaping the field around us to contain and collect the deluge.
I noticed that none of it had washed through the open doorway into the hollow pit level. When the microfield had lifted the water away in sloshing spheres, I found my sodden towel and walked through the doorway into the ship. As the hull irised shut behind me, the water presumably being returned to its holding tanks before being purified again for our use or as reaction mass, I stopped suddenly. "Ship," I demanded.
"Yes, Emendymion?"
"That wasn't your idea of a practical joke, was it?"
"Do you mean obeying your order to collapse the zero-g microfield, Emendymion?"
"Yeah." "The consequences were the result of a minor oversight only, Emendymion. I do not commit practical jokes. Be assured, I do not suffer from a sense of humor." "Hmm," I said, not totally convinced. Carrying my wet shoes and clothing with me, I squished upstairs to dry off and get dressed.
The next day I visited A. Bettick down in what he called the engine room. The place did have somewhat the sense of an engine room in an ocean-going ship. Warm pipes, obscure but massive dynamo-shaped objects, catwalks and metal platforms. But A. Bettick showed me how the primary purpose of the space was to interface with the ship's drives and field generators via various stim-sim-like connectors. I admit that I've never enjoyed computer-generated realities, and after sampling a few of the virtual views of the ship, I disconnected and sat by A. Bettick's hammock while we talked. He told me about helping to service and refit this ship over the long decades, and how he had begun to believe it would never fly again. I sensed a relief that the voyage was underway. "Had you always planned to go on the trip with whomever the old poet chose to go with the girl?" I asked. The android looked steadily at me. "For the past century, I have harbored the thought, M. Endymion, but I rarely considered it a potential reality. I thank you for making it so." His gratitude was so sincere that it embarrassed me for a moment.
"You'd better not thank me until we escape the Pax," I said to change the subject. "I suppose they'll be waiting for us in Renaissance Vector Space."
"It seems likely."
The blue-skinned man did not seem especially concerned by the prospect. "Do you think Aenea's threat of opening the ship to space will work a second time?" I said. A. Bettick shook his head.
"They wish to capture the girl alive, but they will not be taken in by that bluff again."
I raised my eyebrows.
"Do you really think she was bluffing? I had the impression that she was ready to open our level to vacuum."
"I think not," said A. Bettick. "I do not know this young person well, of course, but I had the pleasure of spending some days with her mother and the other pilgrims during their crossing of Hyperion. M. Lamia was a woman who loved life and respected the lives of others. I believe that M. Aenea might have carried out the threat if she had been alone, but I do not think that she is capable of choosing to hurt you or me."
I had nothing to say to that, so we spoke of other things. The ship, our destination. How strange the web worlds must be after all this time since the fall. "If we land on Renaissance Vector," I said, "do you plan to leave us there?"
"Leave you?" said A. Bettick, showing surprise for the first time. "Why would I leave you there?"
I made a lame gesture with my hand.
"Well, I guess. I mean, I always thought you wanted your freedom and would find it on the first civilized world we landed on."
I stopped before I made more of an idiot of myself.
"My freedom is found by being allowed to come along on this voyage," the android said softly.
He smiled.
"And besides, M. Endymion, I could hardly blend in with the populace if I did want to stay on Renaissance Vector." This raised an issue I'd been thinking about.
"You could change your skin color," I said. "The ship's auto-surgeon could do that." I stopped again, seeing something subtle in his expression that I did not understand.
"As you know, M. Endymion," began A. Bettick, "we androids are not programmed like machines, not even set with basic parameters and asymotivators, like the early DNA AIs which evolved into the core intelligences. But certain inhibitions were, strongly urged on us when our instincts were being designed. One, of course, is to obey humans whenever reasonable, and to keep them from coming to harm. This asymotivator is older than robotics or bioengineering, I am told. But another instinct is not to change my skin color."
"You're not capable of it?" I asked.
"You couldn't do it if our lives depended upon your concealing your blue skin?"
"Oh, yes," said A. Bettick. "I am a creature of free will. I could do so, especially if the action was consistent with high-priority asymotivations, such as keeping you and M. Aenea safe from harm. But my choice would make me uncomfortable. Very uncomfortable."
I nodded, but did not really understand. We spoke of other things. This was the same day that I inventoried the contents of the weapons and evil lockers on the main airlock level. There was more there than I'd thought upon first inspection,
and some of the objects were so archaic that I had to ask the ship their purpose. Most of the things in the Eva locker were obvious enough. Space suits and hazardous atmosphere suits. 4 flybikes cleverly folded into their storage niches under the spacesuit closet. Heavy-duty hand lamps. Camping gear. Osmosis masks and scuba gear with flippers and spear guns. 1 EM flying belt. 3 boxes of tools. 2 well-equipped med kits. 6 sets of night vision and IR goggles. An equal number of lightweight headsets with mic bead communicators and vid cameras and comm logs. These last items caused me to query the ship. On a world without a datasphere, I had grown up with little use for the things. The comm logs ranged from antiquated, the thin silver band of jewelry type that was popular several decades ago, to absolutely ancient, massive things the size of a small book. All were capable of being used as communicators, of storing massive amounts of data, of tapping into the local datasphere, and, especially with the older ones, of actually hooking into planetary fatline relays via remote, so that the megasphere could be accessed. I held one of the bracelet pieces in my palm. It weighed much less than a gram. Useless. I understood from listening to off-world hunters that there were a few worlds with primitive dataspheres once again. Renaissance Vector was one of them, I thought. But the fatline relays have been useless for almost 3 centuries. The fatline, that common band of FTL communication upon which the hegemony had depended, had been silent since the fall. I started to put the comm log back in its velvet-lined case. "You might find it useful to take with you if you leave me for any period of time," said the ship. I glanced over my shoulder. "Why?"
"Information," said the ship. "I would be happy to download the bulk of my basic data logs into 1 or more of those. You could access it at will."
I chewed my lip, trying to imagine any value in having the ship's confused mass of data on my wrist. Then I heard Grandam's voice from my childhood.
"Information is always to be treasured, Rawl. It is behind only love and honesty in a person's attempt to understand the universe."
"Good idea," I said, snapping the thin silver thread around my wrist. "When can you download the databanks?"
"I just did," said the ship.
I had gone through the weapons locker carefully before we had reached Parvati space. There had been nothing there which could have slowed a Swiss guardsman for a second. Now I studied the contents of the locker with different purposes in mind. It is odd how old things look old. The spacesuits and flybikes and hand lamps, almost everything aboard the ship, seemed antiquated, out of style. There were no skin suits, for instance, and the bulk, design, and color of everything seemed like a hollow from a history text. But the weapons were a slightly different story. They were old, yes, but very familiar to my eye and hand. The consul had obviously been a hunter. There were 6 shotguns on the rack, well-oiled and stored properly. I could have taken any one of them and headed for the fens to bag ducks. They ranged from a petite 310 over and under to a massive 28-gauge double barrel. I chose an ancient but perfectly preserved 16-gauge pump with actual cartridges and set it in the corridor. The rifles and energy weapons were beautiful. The consul must have been a collector, because these specimens were works of art as well as killing devices. Scroll work on the stocks, blue steel, hand-fitted elements, perfect balance. In the millennium and more since the 20th century, when personal weapons were mass-produced to be incredibly deadly, cheap, and ugly as metal doorstops, some of us, the consul and I among the few, had learned to treasure beautiful handmade or limited production guns. On the rack here were high-caliber hunting rifles, plasma rifles, not a misnomer, I had learned while in Home Guard basic training. The plasma cartridges were bolts of sheer energy, of course, when they emerged from the barrel, but the cartridges did benefit from the barrel's rifling before they volatilized. 2 elaborately carved laser-based energy rifles, this was a misnomer, an artifact of language rather than design. Not that different from the one M. Herrick had killed Izzy with not so many days earlier. A matte black force assault rifle, that probably resembled the one Colonel Fedmon Cassad had brought to Hyperion 3 centuries ago, a huge bore plasma weapon that the consul must have used for shooting dinosaurs on some world, and 3 handguns. There were no death wands. I was glad. I hated the damned things. I removed one of the plasma rifles, the force assault weapon, and the handguns for further inspection. The force weapon was ugly, an exception to the consul's collecting scheme, but I saw why it had been useful. The thing was multi-purpose, an 18mm plasma rifle, a variable beam coherent energy weapon, grenade launcher, a beekeeper, beams of high-energy electrons, fleshette launcher, a wideband blinder, heat-seeking dart flinger. Hell, a force assault weapon could do everything but cook the troopers' meals. And when in the field, the variable beam set to low could usually do that as well. Before entering Parvati's system, I had toyed with greeting any Swiss Guard boarders with the force weapon, but modern combat suits would have shrugged off everything it could dole out, and, to be honest, I had been afraid it would make the PAX troopers mad. Now I studied it more carefully. Something this flexible might be useful if we wandered too far from the ship, and I had to take on a more primitive foe, say a caveman or a jet fighter, or some poor slob equipped as we had been in Hyperion's home guard. In the end, I rejected taking it. It was prohibitively heavy, if one weren't in an old force exo-powered combat suit. The thing had no ammunition for the fleshette, grenade, or bee settings. 18mm pulse cartridges were impossible to find anymore, and to use the energy weapon options, I would have to be near the ship or some other serious power source. I set the assault gun back in place, realizing as I did so that it might well have been the legendary Colonel Cassad's personal weapon. It did not fit the profile of the consul's personal collection, but he had known Cassad. Perhaps he had kept the thing for sentimental reasons. I asked the ship, but the ship did not remember. Surprise, surprise, I muttered. The handguns were more ancient than the assault gun, but much more promising. Each was a collector's item, but they used cartridge magazines that could still be purchased, at least on Hyperion. I couldn't vouch for the worlds we would visit. The biggest weapon was a 60-caliber Steiner Ginn full-auto penetrator. It was a serious weapon, but heavy. The cartridge templates weighed almost as much as the handgun, and it was designed to use ammunition at a prodigious rate. I set it back. The other two were more promising. A small, light, eminently portable fleshette pistol that might have been the great granddaddy of the weapon M. Herrig had tried to kill me with. It came with several hundred shiny little needle eggs. The grip magazine held 5 at a time. And each of the eggs held several thousand of the fleshettes. It was a good weapon for someone who was not necessarily a good shot. The final handgun amazed me. It was in its own oiled leather holster. I removed the weapon with fingers that were slightly shaking. I knew it only from old books. A 45-caliber semi-automatic handgun, actual cartridges, the kind that came in brass casings. Not a magazine template that created them as the gun was fired. Patterned grip, metal sights, blue steel. I turned the weapon over in my hands. This thing could date back more than 1,000 years. I looked in the case in which I had found it. 5 boxes of 45 cartridges, several hundred rounds. I thought that they must be ancient as well, but I found the manufacturer's tag. Lucis, about 3 centuries ago. Hadn't Braun Lamia carried an ancient 45, according to the Kantos? Later, when I asked Ania, the child said that she had never seen her mother with a handgun. Still, it and the fleshhead pistol seemed like weapons we should have with us. I did not know if the 45 cartridges would still fire, so I carried one out on the balcony, warned the ship that the external field should stop the slug from ricocheting, and squeezed the trigger. Nothing. Then I remembered that these things had a manual safety. I found it, clicked it off, and tried again. My God, it was loud. But the bullets still worked. I set the weapon in its holster and clipped the holster to my utility belt. It felt right there. Of course, when the last 45 cartridge had been fired, that would be it forever, unless I could find an antique gun club that manufactured them. I don't plan to have to fire several hundred bullets at anything, I thought wryly at the time. If only I had known. Meeting with the girl and android later, I showed them the shotgun and plasma hunting rifle I'd chosen, the flechette pistol, and the 45. If we go wandering through strange places, uninhabited strange places, we should go armed, I said. I offered the flechette pistol to both of them, but they both refused. Ania wanted no weapon. The android pointed out that he could not use one against a human being, and he trusted me to be around if a fierce animal was chasing him. I grunted, but set the rifle, shotgun, and flechette pistol aside. I'll wear this, I said, touching the 45.
It matches your outfit,
Ania said with a slight smile.
There was no last-minute, desperate discussion of a plan this time. None of us believed that Ania's threat of self-destruction would work again if the Pax was waiting. Our most serious discussion of coming events came 2 days before we spun down into the Renaissance system. We had eaten well. A. Bettick had prepared a fillet of river manta with a light sauce, and we had raided the ship's wine cellar for a fine wine from the Beaks Vineyards. And after an hour of music with Ania on the piano, and the android playing a flute he had brought with him, talk turned to the future.
Ship, what can you tell us about Renaissance Vector? Asked the girl.
There was that brief pause that I had come to associate with the ship being embarrassed.
I am sorry, Ania, but other than navigational information and orbital approach maps, which are centuries out of date, I am afraid I have no information about the world.
I have been there, said A. Bettick. Also centuries ago, but we have been monitoring radio and television traffic that refers to the planet.
I've heard some of my off-world hunters talk, I said. Some of the richest are from Renaissance V. I gestured to the android. Why don't you start? He nodded and folded his arms.
Renaissance Vector was one of the most important worlds of the hegemony. Extremely Earth-like on the Solmev scale, it was settled by early seed ships and was completely urbanized by the time of the Fall. It was famous for its universities, its medical centers. Most Poulsen treatments were administered there for the web citizens who could afford it. Its Baroque architecture, especially beautiful in its mountain fortress, Keep Enable, and its industrial output. Most of the four spacecraft were manufactured there. In fact, this spacecraft must have been built there. It was a product of the Mitsubishi Havcheck complex.
Really? Said the ship's voice. If I knew that, the data have been lost. How interesting.
Ania and I exchanged worried glances for the dozenth time on this voyage. A ship that couldn't remember its past or point of origin did not inspire confidence during the complexities of interstellar flight. Oh, well. I thought for the dozenth time. It got us in and out of Parvati system, all right.
Da Vinci is the capital of Renaissance Vector, continued A. Bettick. Although the entire landmass and much of the single large sea are urbanized, so there is a little distinction between one urban center and the other.
It's a busy Pax world, I added. One of the earliest to join the Pax after the Fall. The military is there in spades. Both Renaissance V and Renaissance M have orbital and lunar garrisons, as well as bases all over each planet.
What's Renaissance M? Asked Ania.
Renaissance Minor, said A. Bettick, the second world from the sun. Renaissance V is the third. Minor is also inhabited, but much less so. It is largely an agricultural world, huge automated farms covering much of the planet, and it feeds Vector. After the Fall of the Farcasters, both worlds benefited from this arrangement. Before regularly scheduled interstellar commerce was reinstated by the Pax, the Renaissance system was fairly self-contained. Renaissance Vector manufactured goods. Renaissance Minor provided the food for the 5 billion people on Renaissance Vector.
What's the population on Renaissance V now? I asked.
I believe it is about the same, 5 billion people, give or take a few hundred million. Said A. Bettick. As I said, the Pax arrived early and offered both the cruciform and the birth control regime that goes with it.
You said you'd been there, I said to the android. What's the world like?
Ah, said A. Betic with a rueful smile. I was at the Renaissance Vector spaceport for less than 36 hours, while being shipped from Asquith in preparation for our colonizing King William's new land on Hyperion. They did rouse us from cryogenic sleep, but did not allow us to leave the ship. My personal recollections of the world are not extensive.
Are they mostly born-again Christians there? Asked Anea.
The girl seemed thoughtful and somewhat withdrawn. I noticed that she had been chewing her nails again.
Oh, yes, said A. Betic.
Almost all 5 billion of them, I'm afraid.
And I wasn't kidding about the heavy Pax military presence, I said. The Pax troopers who trained us in the Hyperion Home Guard staged out of Renaissance V. It's a major garrison world and transshipment point for the whole war against the ousters.
Anea nodded, but still seemed distracted. I decided not to beat around the bush.
Why are we going there? I asked.
She looked up at me. Her dark eyes were beautiful but remote that moment.
I want to see the River Tethys.
I shook my head. The River Tethys was a Farcaster construct, you know. It didn't exist outside the web. Or rather, it existed as 1,000 small sections of other rivers.
I know, she said. But I want to see a river that was part of Tethys during the web days. My mother told me about it. How it was like the Grand Concourse, only more leisurely. How one could ride a barge from world to world for weeks, months.
I resisted the impulse to get angry. You know, there's almost no chance we can get past their defenses to Renaissance Vector, I said. And if we get there, River Tethys won't be there, just whatever portion used to be part of it. What's so important about seeing that? The girl started to shrug, then caught herself.
Remember how I said that there's an architect I need to... want to study with?
Yes, I said. But you don't know his name or what world he's on, so why come to Renaissance Vector to start your search? Couldn't we look on Renaissance Minor at least? Or just skip this system and go somewhere empty like Armagast?
Anea shook her head. I noticed that she had brushed her hair especially well. The blonde highlights were very visible.
In my dreams, she said, one of the architect's buildings lies near the River Tethys.
There are hundreds of other old Tethys worlds, I said, leaning closer to her so she could see that I was very serious. Not all of them will get us caught or killed by the Pax. Do we have to start in Renaissance system?
I think so, she said softly.
I dropped my large hands to my knees. Martin Silenus had not said that this trip would be easy or make sense. He had just said that it would make me a hero.
All right, I said again, hearing the weariness in my own voice. What's our plan this time, kiddo?
No plan, said Anea. If they're waiting for us, I'm just going to tell them the truth, that we're going to land the ship on Renaissance Vector. I think they'll let us land.
And if they do? I said, trying to imagine the ship surrounded by thousands of Pax troopers.
We'll take it from there, I guess, said the girl.
She smiled at me.
Want to play 1/6G billiards, you two, for money this time?
I started to say something sharp, then changed my tone. You don't have any money, I said. Anea's grin grew wider.
Then I can't lose, can I?